I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, we frequently use the word headache to describe the little annoyances in life, but for millions of people, a headache is not an inconvenience. It's a full-body emergency. It's debilitating. Journalist Tom Zeller Jr. has lived for decades with cluster headaches, a condition some patients compare to being stabbed in the eye with a red-hot poker. In his new book, The Headache, he takes us inside the hidden world of pain that most of us never experience and we don't want to. We're going to hear about why these headache disorders are so often dismissed, how they impact families, workplaces, and the economy, and the deep gender bias that shapes who gets believed and who gets brushed off. How have headaches, like migraines, impacted your life? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Need to get rid of your property? Here's a simple solution. Donate it to TPR. Visit tpr.careasy.org/realestatedonation to learn more.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. For lots of us, a headache is just a minor annoyance, something you can conquer with an aspirin and a good night's sleep. But for millions of people, head pain is something very different. It's disabling, life-changing, life-shaping. It can even steal days, jobs, relationships, and a sense of self. Migraines, cluster headaches, and other severe headache disorders are among the leading causes of disability worldwide, yet they are widely misunderstood, minimized, or even joked about. But when we talk about headaches as a serious, terrible health condition, we just really need to refocus on what it is that we're talking about. The word headache doesn't really seem to grasp the situation. Journalist Tom Zeller Jr. knows this reality all too well. He has spent decades living with cluster headaches and reporting on the science and the mystery, the history of pain. His new book is called The Headache, The Science of the Most Confounding Affliction and a Search for Relief. Tom Zeller Jr., welcome to The Source.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Our phone lines are open. We do want to hear your headache story. How has it impacted you or how someone in your family or relationship? 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So, Tom, your book is part memoir. It's part investigation into one of the most common and most neglected health problems on the planet. Why do you think so many people don't recognize the problem of chronic headaches?
That's a great question. I think it's multifaceted. You touched on it in the introduction. I think the word headache is a word that sort of entered our lexicon as something to signify just a mere annoyance. It's a headache to do your taxes. Sitting in traffic is a headache. So I think there's a little bit of a semantic or linguistic tension there that helps to trivialize the matter. But I also think, well, and also I think that the fact that all of us do get some sort of headache. I mean, I get headaches if I don't, you know, drink enough water, or maybe if I skip lunch or get a hunger headache. We all get these kinds of things. And, you know, it's a category difference when we're talking about migraines and cluster headaches, yet we sort of gravitate towards the same word for both. And that also helps to complicate things. And I think the third factor, which I get at in the book a fair bit, is the fact that migraine, which is probably the most widely debilitating malady, is inordinately experienced by women by an order of 3 to 1. And I'm not saying anything revolutionary when I suggest that women's healthcare in general has been given short shrift over the years. So I think that to the extent that women were presenting more often in clinicians' office over the decades or even centuries, I think a lot of times it was like many other health disorders that are attributable to women. It was described as hysteria. It was described as, you know, you need to relax more. And so it wasn't really taken seriously by the scientific establishment. all that aside, I also think that, you know, they're incredibly complicated disorders. So there's that too.
But they're so widespread. I mean, everyone knows someone who has migraines or severe headaches. It's not that uncommon. It may not affect you, but you know someone who has to deal with these things. Why don't we really recognize it as a societal problem, something that does cost the economy? Why don't we pour more research into understanding them and coming up with better relief?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a certain sort of stigma attached to headache, and that bleeds into the research culture, that bleeds into science itself. So, you know, to the extent that I think the culture tends to attach, intentionally or not, a certain sense of malingering in people who sort of complain about headache. I mean, there's a famous book called Not Tonight, which is written by another researcher about headache. But it makes reference to a joke, right? I mean, women get out of having sex with their husbands by saying, honey, I have a headache. So we've sort of incorporated a sense of these afflictions as meaning, you know, an attempt to get out of something, an attempt to sort of make excuses. And so I think that that does bleed into the wider scientific culture. And I have to tell you, in reporting out this book, I spoke to a lot of scientists who have devoted their lives to studying headache or to treating it in the clinic. And I'd say almost every one of them said that when they were in medical school and expressed an interest in studying headache, they were often discouraged by their mentors from doing so because, you know, it was not a really serious illness. It was a waste of time. You can't really help these people. Why you're such a bright scientist. Why would you devote your life to this? So, you know, to the extent that that sort of that residue of bias attaches to these disorders, it's not surprising in that sense that we don't take it more seriously.
For someone who is studying medicine to become a doctor, about how much training do they get on headaches?
Very little. I was told by students who are even in medical school right now that it's discussed for maybe a half an hour or something as part of a larger neurological neuroscience track. So they don't get a lot of education on headache medicine at all. There are organizations that do offer specialized training in headache science and in headache clinical treatment, but someone has to sort of step forward and say, "I want to do that proactively." You're not going to get that as part of your regular coursework in medical school.
Someone who says, "I have severe headaches. I have migraines. I have cluster headaches like you," and I'll ask you more about that. Do they qualify for things like Social Security disability? How do they show that they actually have this?
Not typically. It's actually quite hard to get support, social support, and funding, disability funding, for a strictly a headache disorder. I mean, it's much easier. I mean, if you can demonstrate an injury of some kind, it's always going to be much easier. And I do talk in the book a bit about the struggle within the headache advocacy movement to get, say, the Social Security Administration to pay more attention to the disabling aspects of migraine, and, you know, an ancillary byproduct of that would be other headache disorders like mine, and that touches on probably another issue with regard to why they're not taken so seriously. It's invisible, and I think for a lot of disorders that are invisible, it is very hard to sort of convince people who don't experience it what it's like. You don't have, there's no machine to measure the pain you're in. There's no scan that will identify, there's your headache. It doesn't actually exist in any place that we've been able to identify, even though people experiencing it can feel it in a very specific place. If you were to scan that person experiencing that, you would see nothing wrong in that part of the head where they're feeling this. So it's a very obviously complicated set of neurological and vascular events happening, but we can't show anybody that pain, and that also makes it hard.
No biomarkers. We're going to talk more about that. We're going to talk about the bias, the self-stigma, the complicated history of headaches, what's the future look like for treatment of these. But we do want to hear from our listeners. Do you get these types of headaches or someone in your family? What is that like? Why don't you think we take headaches seriously? Why do we always say it's all in your head? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source comes back in 1 minute.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. There are headaches, and then there are headaches. Headaches that are debilitating, life-altering, just chronic, sometimes they've been described as suicide headaches. The new book, The Headache, The Science of a Most Confounding Affliction and a Search for Relief, talks about that, dives into that, goes into the history of it. And we're joined by the author, Tom Zeller Jr. You can call in and tell us your headache story. I think we do need to have a public awareness campaign to help other people, I mean, who don't have headaches, like me, what we need to know in order we can treat this with some compassion and empathy and figure out how do we dedicate the appropriate resources to dealing with this affliction that does hit millions and millions of people. Call in 833-877-8255. And let's go to Dawn on the phones. And Dawn, you're on the air.
Hi. I totally understand the misunderstanding of what this headache syndrome is, you know, what people go through. I have recently been diagnosed with Sjogren's syndrome, and, you know, for the last 5 years, my migraines were getting worse and worse, and we couldn't figure it out, you know, what was going on. It was a side effect of other things, of an autoimmune disorder, but nonetheless, all my life dealing with allergies and what have you, just trying to figure out these debilitating headaches, and doctors couldn't give me an answer. And a lot of times as a woman, I would get exactly those responses when I would go in to see a doctor. You're just stressed. It's anxiety. Try to relax. And these headaches would bring me down. I couldn't go to work. I just needed to sleep in a dark room, and to the point where of nausea and so on. And it really is frustrating, and it affects your life completely.
How often do you get them, and how long they last?
Just depends on how fast I catch it, but typically 2 to 3, maybe sometimes 4 times a week. And they can go anywhere from lasting an hour to days at a time.
Wow, Dawn, thank you so much for calling in. I'm sorry about all that. Tom, you want to react to Dawn?
Well, I would have liked to ask her, you know, if she's finding something that works for her. One of the big things, challenges for people who are experiencing disorders is that there are not a lot of tailor-made medications.
So we brought Dawn back so she could answer that question. So Dawn, what's your treatment like?
Well, it started off usually Excedrin migraine takes away my headache if I catch it early on enough. As I've gotten older, that hasn't always worked because caffeine is not supposed to be good for the other things I've got going on with my body. So I have to try to stay away from caffeine, and there is a lot of caffeine in those medications. But I've been diagnosed, you know, here more recently, and I've been given actual medication that actually works. I mean, right now the name of the medication slips my mind, but that works when my headaches have actually gone to the level of nausea and just not being able to think clearly. That makes a big difference.
All right, Dawn.
And
so
that
Tom,
medication is designed specifically to treat your headache, or it's designed to treat something else and the headache goes away as a result?
It is actually designed specifically for headaches. Yeah, and okay. I'm not at home, so I can't pull the medication up to tell you the name of it. But I'll be honest with you, I'm real funny also about taking medications, so I'm not as diligent about that. I've already had these migraines so long in my life that I already recognize the triggers and the symptoms, and so I try to catch it before it gets worse. So usually something over the counter will do the trick, or rest, and I will, just try to stay away from the triggers, because I'm highly allergic. It could be anything from something that I eat, or even an odor or something in the air that causes me, that triggers the headache. So,
wow, Dawn, thank you for your call. So, Tom, how common is Dawn's story?
It's extremely common. It's a gauntlet usually for anyone experiencing these things to try and discover a medication that works. And up until a few years ago, that exclusively meant being given drugs that were developed for other disorders and just happened in some people to show some efficacy for lessening a headache. So a typical migraine patient like Dawn would be prescribed an anti-epileptic or an anti-seizure medication. They might get an antidepressant. They would probably be experimenting with some calcium channel blockers, which are blood pressure medications. All these kinds of things that operate and were developed in order to treat other disorders, but maybe sometimes for some people had an effect and could help with their headaches. I would guess that she probably is also taking a triptan, which is the one drug that came out in the 1990s that is pretty good at silencing an individual headache. It would be called an abortive, so it stops a headache that you happen to be having, but it does nothing to prevent the next one and the next one and the next one. And it's sort of characteristic of these disorders that the next one is always going to come very soon. So other than that, and the problem with those triptans is that you can't take it too often because it has other side effects that are not very good. So that was sort of the imperfect tableau that most headache patients had to navigate for most of the history of headache medicine. That's starting to change.
I'm going to listen to a voicemail that we received. Let's give a listen.
Hey, David. This is Amy Hamrick. Love your show, and I'm glad you're talking about headaches. Headaches are just such a part of my life, and I hate saying that, but I always wish that I could articulate how much, like, thought goes into my day-to-day preparation in order to not have a headache. And when migraines come on, it is, even though I have medicine, it is so disturbing, and there's no pain quite like it. It is the most exquisitely excruciating pain that I've ever known. And I appreciate you taking this today and talking about it.
And so, Tom, you have headaches. You have cluster headaches. That's not a migraine. What are cluster headaches, and why are they called suicide headaches?
Sure. So cluster headaches are far more rare. Migraine affects something like 15% of the population. As I said, mostly women by an order of 3-1. Cluster affects less than 1% of the population. And strangely, it seems to be more men than women by roughly the same ratio. And they're distinguished from migraine in the in a variety of ways. One is that the headaches that come on tend to be incredibly intense. Scientific literature has described it as possibly the worst pain known to human beings. Whether or not that's true, I don't know. I don't even know how they would measure such a thing. But I can promise you that each headache is an emergency. I could not be talking to you. I would be pacing, I would be banging my head against something. I mean, the pain is I describe the intensity as akin to putting your hand on a hot burner, but not being able to take it off. It's at that level of intensity. It is shorter lived than a migraine, however. So it comes on very quick, within seconds, usually. You don't know it's about to come. And then I might be just sitting here, and then suddenly I'm thrown to the floor with this incredible pain behind my right eyeball. And if I did nothing, I would be sort of rolling around on the floor for an hour or two, and then in a matter of seconds, it would just evaporate and go away. And that's, and then it would come back again, maybe a few hours later, and it would continue to do that for two, maybe 3 months out of the year. And then for reasons that we can't explain, the attacks would go away. And that's where the name cluster headache comes from, that they come in clusters at around certain times of year. It's not really predictable. I used to think maybe it had to do with the seasons or something for me, but it never ended up being quite that perfect. And so, yeah, that's how it gets its name. And migraine, my sense is that it's a much more, it's definitely a deep and boring pain, maybe not quite as intense, but much, much, much more long-lived. I mean, I talked to a lot of patients and even some that we've talked to here who probably are down for hours and hours, if not days, or maybe even a week with grinding head pain. So, you know, while they have different characteristics, these are both very disabling disorders.
I mean, you have written for the New York Times, mm-hmm. a successful journalist. You know, you're on deadline probably all the time. How do you deal with all that?
Yeah. So, well, I should say that I'm a former New York Times reporter and editor. I'm independent now, but I was going through the worst of it while I was a reporter at the Times. I think I was fortunate in that, you know, because clusters are what they are, I could sort of shrink from my responsibilities in certain ways, or kind of go and hide either in the newsroom or work from home during the couple of months out of the year where it was happening, and try to work around it in that way. And then when the headaches would go away, I was essentially cured, not by anything I did, but by the disorder itself. We don't know why it turns on and turns off. And during those, you know, 6-8 months that I was pain free, I could, you know, be quite successful and do what I needed to do. So in that sense, I felt quite lucky. But I was always sort of, what drove me to write the book was this nagging concern that I'd had most of my life with, you know, what is being done scientifically to understand these things. And I can understand that cluster is quite rare and rare diseases have a harder time getting attention and resources, but migraine is legion. Why don't we know more? And it seems certain that, you know, whatever is going on physiologically in a migraine almost certainly has similar affinities to cluster headache, to tension headache, to all kinds of other primary headache disorders. And if we could crack the code of migraine, we would almost certainly help tens of millions of other people with other kinds of headache. And so it just was always very fascinating to me that we did not know more.
Well, the malady is bad enough, but then to have some people suspect that maybe it's you know, self, mm-hmm. it's not real, you know, maybe yeah. you didn't have your, you know, your stuff together. And so now you're saying you have a headache. So because you didn't make deadline or something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or maybe you have a headache, but I have headaches too. And I can tough it out. So maybe you're just kind of weak and sort of, you know, not really cut out for this kind of work. I mean, you would certainly get that sort of sense, maybe not from my colleagues, but you certainly absorb it from the culture, and you don't have to dig far into literature or into television shows or into, you know, I have a great anecdote about Scottie Pippen, you know, the famous basketball player who very famously during an early 1990s playoff series experienced a migraine and was known to have migraines and performed terribly. And he was absolutely mercilessly ridiculed by the press and by some of his teammates for saying he had a migraine and that's why he performed badly. This is sort of standard issue for people who experience these things.
Right, he would be taunted by the fans.
Yeah, sure.
Scotty got a headache. Even mm-hmm. Michael Jordan showed some lack of sympathy there.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It was a bit of an eye roll, right? And the interesting thing with Pippen's migraine, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners experience this too, is that there are a lot of neurological symptoms that coincide with the pain. So the pain is just one thing, but a lot of migrainers have all kinds of other neurological symptoms that include an inability to see, They have oral hallucinations. They can have extreme nausea. Sometimes it becomes like a balance issue. All of which seem to me to be clear signs that some, you know, a neurological event is unfolding in these people. And yet, you know, we sort of roll our eyes at them.
We're taking another break here. We're going to get Barbara on the air when we come back, and we want to hear your headache story, your migraines, your cluster headaches. These things are real. They're severe. We need to talk about them, raise awareness that this needs to be addressed and needs to be taken seriously. It's not to be joked and mocked. You can call in 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. How has this impacted you? How do you deal with it? The Source comes back after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Headache is a new book. The Headache, the Science of a Most Confounding Affliction and a Search for Relief. We're joined by the author, Tom Zeller Jr. He also suffers from cluster headaches. And we're taking your calls. We'd want to hear about how you deal with headaches and what we need to do to raise awareness. This is a real affliction, needs to be taken seriously and not to be just brushed off. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And Barbara, thanks for calling in. Barbara, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes, you sound great.
Yeah. Yes. So, yeah, headaches have been with me for a long, long time. So I also wanted to ask about, there's a genetic factor, I think, with it. My mother had suffered from it a lot when I grew up, and then I had it in my childbearing years. It was somewhat dependent on, you know, getting periods around that time. It would get really, really worse, you know, back when, I mean, all I knew how to take was aspirin, ibuprofen, which wouldn't do a thing. So I would be just miserable for sometimes days at a time and having to work and how difficult that is, you know. And as I got older, the per se migraines have lessened, and I developed what's known as hypnic headaches. I had never even heard of it. When a neurologist, they're also known under alarm clock headaches. It's like you wake up with this pressure in your head at like 2-3 o'clock in the morning, hence alarm clock headache. And you have to get up. And actually what helps a lot of times is to drink caffeine, which then of course you can't go back to sleep, and that's a vicious cycle. And, you know, also wanted to mention, of course, this affects your mental health. You know, mm-hmm. because it is so little misunderstood and people do brush it off, because if you've never had it, you really can't relate. You know, you can't relate for something you've never had. But so I just wanted to put that in there.
Well, that's
Thank
great.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
You added a lot to the conversation, Barbara. Thank you. So, Tom, your reaction?
Yeah, so a lot of that really resonated with me and reminds me of a lot of the migraineurs that I spoke to in reporting the book. she mentioned the genetic component. There's definitely a clear genetic signal in migraine. It's not perfect. I mean, there obviously are lots of people who develop migraine and certainly can't find a family member who also has it. But it does tend to show up in familial lines. The one caveat being that so far our genetic studies into migraine have not identified any specific gene that seems to be related to it. It seems to be sort of a suite or a network of genes operating independently that are involved in the production of migraine headache. And that becomes a complicating factor when you're looking for medications. It's much easier if you can identify a specific gene that's sort of related to a disorder. It leads to more possible therapies. But there is definitely a genetic component, less so for cluster. There's not really, such that I know, been a clear genetic signal in people who suffer from cluster headache. What I will say is that Barbara mentioned that the headaches became much worse during menstrual cycles, which is also incredibly common and a clear signal to most scientists that there's obviously a very large hormonal component here. So the ebb and flow of hormones in our bodies almost certainly play a role in the generation of these disorders. It's unclear, though, exactly. That's not led to any sort of new therapies, per se. And it's also common, and this is happening for me too, that a lot of people who have these disorders age out. You end up, as you get older, they tend to lessen. Not for everyone, which is sort of the heartbreak for a lot of people, but in a large number of patients, as you age, you know, from middle age into your elder years, the headaches often can stop. And that's another clear sign that changes in metabolism or hormone flow are probably playing a role.
How much do these jackhammer headaches, how much do they cost society?
Oh, on the order of billions. I mean, no perfect study has been able to pin it down, but you know, there are organizations like the World Health Organization that have done number crunching, and migraine is among the top five most disabling disorders out there in terms of lost functionality. So if you add up all the time that a person spends curled up in bed with their head sort of pounding and unable to function, unable to work, unable to sort of engage with their families. If you add up all those hours, they do become years. And in terms of years lost to disability, migraine, surprisingly, is quite up there. And so that almost certainly translates into tens of, you know, billions of dollars in potential savings if we could figure out how to crack this nut, which is another reason why I'm always surprised that we don't devote more resources to studying it.
Let's go to Jody on the phones. And Jody, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a daughter. She's now an adult, but when she was a child, she actually had seizures, and she had a variety of different types of seizures. And several medications, we were able to get her seizure-free. She grew up and started having really bad headaches, and we found out that they were actually tied to seizure activity, even though she wal having the full-blown grand mal seizures anymore. And she didn't want to go back on seizure medication just because they have a lot of bad side effects. And so after doing some research, found out that vitamin B is a seizure medication. And so she was taking a lot of vitamin B, and we increased the creatine levels in her food. And it really helped out with those horrible headaches that she would get. But then I come to find out that if you have a vitamin B deficiency, you can also have really bad headaches. So I thought it was rather interesting that just changing that diet really helped.
All right. Jody, thank you for that. So, Tom, you know, when you hear a story like that, they found something that works for them. How transmissible is that to other people?
You know, I would say first, I would say, you know, anyone who finds their own path to relief, I say Godspeed. And a lot of headache medicine is really about that. Each person sort of needs to find their own combination of things that work. I'm quite sure that diet, can play a role in that, you know, what we put into our gut has an almost direct line through the vagus nerve into the brain. There's a really strong superhighway that delivers information back and forth from there. And so, you know, when we see things like people experiencing nausea and during a migraine, or when we see people who are quite sure that certain foods trigger their migraine attacks, it seems certain that there is a chemical or an electrical signal pathway there that plays a role. So it wouldn't surprise me that, you know, Jody's daughter could find some relief by adjusting diet or adding, say, vitamin B. Vitamin D is another vitamin that's being studied in more so in the realm of cluster headache, but it's not unusual at all that these things that what we consume may have some role to play. That said, I don't think I've ever heard of anyone who is completely cured by simply changing what they eat. It almost always finds a way around those adjustments and comes back. That's not to say that I hope I'm not giving Jody bad news there. And I think
if it works for them,
yeah. It works for them, God bless. Yeah.
Okay, let's go to Cindy. And Cindy, you're on the air. Go ahead, Cindy.
Hi. I've had migraines since I was 11, and I'm 78 now. I have classic migraines, been diagnosed by many physicians. I finally, in the last 5 years, found some medication that I inject, and it prevents the migraines from happening. Once a migraine starts, you really can't stop it, or I can't. And I have the visual, I have the aura, I know I'm going to have one when I get the aura, which is a visual disturbance. And then a little bit later, the migraine starts and the opposite side of my body goes numb. Parts of it can go numb without the whole body. Sometimes it's an arm and a hand. Sometimes it's the leg. But this particular drug was, I think it's a foreign company, but it's made at the Triangle in North Carolina. It's a Jovi, and it's a monoclonal antibody. I'm a clinical chemist, so I know what they're talking about. I read a lot on it. It's a monoclonal antibody, which when you inject it, it goes to your brain, and there's four proteins that they have identified that start the migraine. And it works like a charm. I went 15 months without a single migraine and was having as many as, I don't know, maybe I didn't have 20 or whatever. And unfortunately, Medicare doesn't pay for it. So I could not afford it after that period. And now my migraines are back. But I fully believe there's more of I think it's genetic. There's five people in my family that have migraines.
Right.
And classic migraines. And the classic one is what I have.
Cindy, thank you for that. We're going to go to this break, and then it's a one-minute break, and then we're going to come back. We're here from Tom reacting to what you told us. It's an incredible story. The thing about Medicare is also really interesting. And we want to hear from more of our listeners about their headache, massive headache, migraines, cluster headaches. What has happened to you? How do you deal with it? What do you want people to know? 833-877-8255. The Source comes back right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The headache, the science of a most confounding affliction and a search for relief. The author is Tom Zeller, Jr., and a veteran of science journalism, and he is a sufferer of cluster headaches. As this is a part memoir and also a discourse on the history of and the future of trying to deal with headaches, with something that has plagued humanity since the beginning. Tom, what did you think of Cindy's call?
Yeah, so Cindy offered a nice opportunity to talk about these new medications. She mentioned Ajovy, which is the brand name it's called a CGRP blocker. CGRP is the name of a neuropeptide. It's a signaling molecule in the nervous system. And what these new brands of medication like Ajovy and other CGRP inhibitors do is they block either the expression of CGRP in the bloodstream, or they inhibit they block the receptor so that it inhibits the molecule from being taken up. So these emerged on the market in 2018. They came at the end of about 30 years of investigatory work that involved studying patients in the throes of a migraine and actually drawing blood from their jugular veins while this was happening, and studying the blood and trying to figure out are there certain chemicals that are elevated during this event. CGRP turned out to be one of those. And so this whole suite of medications were designed to block it. You do take it by injection most often, although there are oral versions of this coming out now, and they work really, really well for a lot of people. The problem is they don't work for everyone, and the true real world efficacy level for these is sort of a matter of debate, but I would say that, you know, it's somewhere in the order of about 50 to 60% of people find some relief, some reduction in the number of headaches that they have in a given, say, month, which is terrific. It doesn't stop them entirely.
The Medicare or insurance coverage?
Yeah, not very difficult to get coverage for it, even now that we've had it for, what, six, seven years that they've been on the market. Medicaid is difficult, and a lot of insurances are difficult to convince that this medication is superior to the sort of hand-me-down medications that we talked about earlier in terms of their efficacy. A lot of doctors will tell you in their own experience, these things work so much better and that it's outrageous that insurance won't cover these drugs. That's not universal. I mean, some insurance companies will cover this, but it's sort of hit and miss. And until a signal from, say, Medicaid comes down and says, yes, this is a drug that we must cover now because it seems to be the best drug that we have for treating these things, until that signal comes from the federal government, a lot of other insurers won't take the step of covering it on their own. And that's what patients are facing even now, including Sydney, which is a shame because she found great relief and now she can't afford to get it.
Yeah, and we're seeing what's happening now with the CDC, not in good shape. Let's go to James. And James, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'm glad to talk about this. I'm glad y'all are covering this topic. I started having ocular migraines about 15 years ago, and they came out of nowhere. One day I just had this migraine, and I saw the aura. I had confusion. I couldn't think straight. I had numbness in my extremities. And I actually went to the ER. I thought I was having a stroke. And I saw a doctor. They told me they did all these tests. And they told me they thought it was a migraine. So I went to see a neurologist down on Broadway. And they actually prescribed Topamax, which I believe was a seizure medication. And it worked great. I didn't have any more migraines. But the side effects were terrible. Depression, anxiety, weight loss. And so I had to get off of that. And I saw another neurologist, and what they recommended was a whole lifestyle change and to stay away from red wine, dark chocolate, to exercise more, to get better sleep. And that helps for the most part. I still get migraines every 2 or 3 months. And what I have to do when I can feel them coming on, when I start having the aura, like your other caller said, is I have to go lay down in a dark room, take some Tylenol, and I put a chilled compression mask over my face, and usually to go away in about an hour or two. But that's been my experience, and thanks again for covering this topic.
James, thank you for that. Tom, the idea that suddenly out of nowhere somebody can start having migraines if you've never had them before and suddenly becomes a new thing in your life, that's pretty scary.
It's really scary, and it's somewhat unusual. It's, you know, a fair number of people who have migraine will start to get it in their younger years, often around puberty. And so for it to suddenly manifest in adult life is less common, but it's still incredibly common, and tens of thousands of people experience it. But if you've never had this sort of event before, it can be incredibly scary. And of course, you'd think you're having a stroke. And all of those signals that James is talking about, the ocular effects, I mean, it's literally like your vision becomes warbled, and it's very difficult to see. To have the aura, you can actually sort of experience the aura as he experiences as numbness in the body. These are all like really, really clear neurological signals. And if it were any other event, I would think that we would take it incredibly seriously. But because it's a headache, we tend to say, well, you know, you're going to be fine. You just have to ride it out. And that seems to be what they did for him. It's interesting to me that this happened somewhat recently, and they only... His neurologist only decided to give him Topamax, which is a drug developed for seizures, and not offer the possibility of these new drugs that Cindy was talking about, which can work very well for people. But even a lot of doctors either don't know about them or just don't bother to mention it because they're accustomed to using these hand-me-down drugs.
had an email from a listener, Tom T-Bone, and he talks about his daily headaches, severe headaches over a decade. He says that he was given Botox at some point with no results. Why Botox?
It's a very, very common, another sort of hand-me-down therapy developed for other things, but it seems to work for a certain percentage of people. It's you know, all probably, you know, half of people get some relief from it. We don't really understand what the mechanism of action is, but you can go and get Botox injections in your face or in certain parts around your head, and some people describe getting a fair amount of relief for this. I was given Botox as one option for my cluster headaches. It did absolutely nothing. So, you know, if anything, it tells us that, you know, all of us have different physiologies, and this is a very difficult thing to sort of tailor make a remedy for.
So how does having a chronic, reoccurring, massive head pain, how does that erode a person's identity over time? How does it change how they see themselves as a part of society, a parent, a partner, friend, worker? What's that? How does that fit in?
You know, my sense is, you know, there's a great variation across the population, and a lot of it depends, you know, these are all spectrum diseases in that, you know, people experience it to different degrees. Some people might get a migraine once a month, and that's fine. Some people get a migraine every day, and those people are ground down such that I've come to know them. And there is an inordinate amount of psychological distress that attaches to these things. There's a lot of guilt that attaches to these things. There's a lot of strange shame, and I think that comes from the stigma of it. But there's no question that there are a lot of psychological comorbidities that come with migraine, and to a certain degree, cluster headache too. Depression is incredibly often goes hand in hand with migraine, and you know, you only have to listen to some of your callers to understand why. I mean, there's not a lot of good options, and society doesn't seem to take you seriously. That seems to me a recipe for depression.
And you can just listen to the number of callers that we've had on the air so far, and we've got some still on the board I'm not going to be able to get to. This is not rare. I mean, this happens to a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, so we're talking 15% of the U.S. population, something like a little over a billion people worldwide experience migraine to varying degrees. Now, if we even assume that only half of those have a version of the disorder that's really truly debilitating, we're still talking about hundreds of millions of people who can't work, who have difficulty sort of maintaining a normal life with their families. And if we could address even some small percentage of those, even half of that half, we would be helping, you know, a quarter of a billion people every year, and injecting that back into the economy. It seems like an easy equation to me.
And your book, The Headache, it does have hopeful tones there about that there are new drugs being developed, new therapies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked about the CGRP medications, which are the most recent to launch. And since those hit the marketplace in 2018, drug companies have developed new, I guess I would call it, flavors of those, so that you don't necessarily always have to inject it, which a lot of people would feel maybe a little bit of an aversion to. There are oral versions of them coming out, and there are actually, we talked about preventive medications versus abortive. There are abortive versions of the new CGRP medications that I would recommend to Cindy, who talked to us before, that actually can stop a headache for many people that's underway. So there's a lot of nice new drugs coming out. We are learning, as I said, that those may wane over time. Like, the longer you're on those drugs, the less they start to work. So people may have to change direction in that way. But I think the science is really invigorating on this front.
The book is The Headache, The Science of a Most Confounding Affliction and a Search for Relief. It's an important book if you have headaches, but also if someone in your life has them, so you have more sympathy. Tom Zeller Jr., thank you so much.
David, thank you very much for having me.
That's The Source. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.